If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
That morning, you know, it was a regular morning. My mom wouldn't answer the door, and of course she opened it, and I heard how pretty. And I heard a bang, and she was on the floor, and then that's when everything just went chaotic. I went right up to her and saw that she had some injury in her mouth. Tooth was cracked up and stuff. I just was watching this individual, you know, at peacefully walking away. It was just like nothing was going on. I mean, the only thing I could see was the eyes, colorful suit, and the big orange nose and orange red hair, the wig and the white gloves and the black shoe boots.
It's a case with an ending that's nearly as jarring as the scene where it all started. 33 years ago, on a Saturday morning, a 40-year-old mother, still dressed in her pink nightgown, is laying in the doorway of her home in Wellington, Florida. Bleeding from her mouth and mortally wounded by a single bullet fired straight into her face. Red and white flowers are scattered around her. Two foil balloons float in the air above. And up ahead, casually walking away from the house is the killer, dressed head to toe in a clown outfit. Within days, investigators were on the case of the killer clown of Wellington. The shocking story had made national news, and it seemed the face beneath the white makeup would soon be revealed. But it would take 3 decades for that to happen. The announcement of an arrest in 2017 was stunning, but brought with it the hope that answers would finally come in one of Florida's most notorious unsolved crimes. What came were more years of waiting, and growing uncertainty about how it would end. The case against Marlene Warren's killer seemed to be hanging by a thread, or to be more accurate, a small orange fiber from a clown wig. Would that tiny piece of evidence be enough to convince a jury that Sheila Keene was the killer clown? It turns out, we may never know. From the South Florida Sun Sentinel, in association with Wondery, this is a special episode of Felonious Florida, the podcast that leads you into the dark side of the Sunshine State. I'm your host, David Schutz, along with reporter Angie DeMichael. This is an update to the case of the killer clown of Wellington that we brought you in Season 2. It was an extraordinary case, and late last month, in April 2023, it came to an equally extraordinary end. We suggest that before continuing that you catch up with the previous episodes in Season 2 by going to feloniousflorida.com/clown. The murder of Marlene Warren on the Saturday of Memorial Day weekend in 1990 shocked South Florida. Marlene was a soft-spoken, caring mother from the Midwest. The house where she was murdered was in a rural but exclusive gated community where crimes just never happened. The killing was cold and calculated, so simplistic it seemed inconceivable that somebody could so easily get away with it. The full clown suit worn by the killer was chilling. And it was brazen, pulled off in broad daylight in front of a handful of witnesses. One of them was Marlene's son, Joe Ahrens. We talked to Joe recently, one of the few interviews he's given over the years since his mother's murder. He was 21 years old the day the clown showed up at his door. He was ready to start his life. He had dreams of going to college and becoming a pilot. Joe spent much of his life in the Wellington home with his mother, brother John, and stepfather Michael Warren. His real father, John Ahrens Sr., died in a car accident when Joe was an infant. So when Marlene remarried a few years later, Michael Warren raised John and Joe as his own. While Michael ran his used car lot, Bargain Motors, Marlene took care of the boys and managed the many rental properties they owned as investments. They had built a life of comfort for Joe and his brother.
My mother was a caring, loving, kind person. She had a big heart, spiritual. She was just a ball of energy. she was my everything, you know, my best friend and someone to come to get advice from. You know, I do miss that today. She bought me a ceramic one time, and she said, "Hey, come on, let's do this." It was a race car with a guy in it with a helmet on, you know, and I did it, and I enjoyed it. You know, the painting, the glazing, I learned a lot from her.
Joe said Marlene was busy raising her sons and managing the rentals, which included everything from painting and plumbing to collecting rent.
You know, when people got behind in rent, she would not get hasty and try to throw them out. She would try to help them. She would give them a chance, you know, and say, you know, we'll work weekly till we get caught up, you know, and work with them. And, you know, she taught me a lot through that. You know, everybody has, you know, a moment that they fall, you know, and they need a little help or time to get up. And that's a big problem today.
But the seemingly happy family life would come to an abrupt end when Joe's brother John, like his father, died in a car crash. It was in 1988 and a turning point for his family. It sent them into a rapid descent into chaos and more tragedy. Marlene and Michael's marriage began showing signs of strain.
After my brother's death, a year and a half before my mother's, we started just you could tell we were starting to get further away instead of pulling together. Me and my mother were becoming together, and my mother had concerns, and she did raise the concerns to him, and he would manipulate and say he would do something and wouldn't.
Joe told us that he thought his mother and stepfather were just going through a phase. It would get better, he told himself. But it wasn't getting better. In fact, by early 1990, it became clear to the people around them that Michael started having an affair with a woman who worked on his car lot repossessing vehicles. Her name was Sheila Keene, and Michael's attention was becoming focused on her. He was spending less and less time at home, and his affair with Sheila had become obvious to many of the people around them, even to Marlene. Joe recalled one encounter during a party at the Warren house, and Sheila was there, along with her husband at the time.
We had a party at her house out in Wellington, and her and Richard showed up, and they had some alligator tail chopped up 1-inch by 1-inch squares, and I guess my dad had the deep fryer up there, and she was going out to help my father cook, and he was explaining to her how to do it. And Mike's mother replied, "Marlene, you better watch that one. She's a pretty one, you know." And my mother replied, "Is that all you're helping them with?" You know, and she said, "Yeah," you know, and that was the end of that one. And I was in the between them, you know, when this was occurring. you know, that was, I guess, the start.
That was just 6 months before Marlene's murder. And Joe said eventually, his mother seemed resigned to the fact that her marriage was likely over.
At one point, A few weeks before it happened, she approached me and asked me if I had anything keeping me here. It was 2 weeks before that I got in a car accident. So it was one thing after another, you know. It was chaos. It was literally hell, you know.
The problems in the Warren marriage had grown to a breaking point. For Michael, that was a serious problem. Because even though he and Marlene had built up considerable wealth, from the car lot to the rental duplexes, Michael owned exactly none of it. It was all in Marlene's name. A divorce with accusations of infidelity would put all their money on the line. Then came Saturday, May 26th, 1990.
That morning, you know, it was a regular morning. 9:30, woke up, we were planning the day. She was saying, you know, we have to do this at this time, we have to do this at this time, and we have to leave at this time, you know. So we were finishing up breakfast.
That's when the clown arrived. It stepped out of a white Chrysler LeBaron, carrying a Memorial Day bouquet of flowers and two foil balloons.
We saw somebody at the front door. Jean said, hey, somebody's at the front door, because the doorbell does not work. And Jean went to go get up, and my mom said, no, sit down, I'll get it. You know, so my mom went and answered the door, and of course she opened it, and I heard how pretty, and I heard a bang, and she was on the floor, and then that's when everything just went chaotic.
The clown had pulled out a pistol and fired it once into Marlene's face. The bullet went through her mouth and lodged in the back of her neck. Marlene was on the floor.
I went right up to her and saw that she had some injury in her mouth. Tooth was cracked up and stuff. That was just painful to see. And I just was watching this individual, you know, and peacefully walking away. It was just like nothing was going on. You know, it was a weird feeling, like a daze, you know, like everything's slow motion, you know. It was a weird feeling, you know, that you really can't explain. I guess reality, you know, because that's what it was. Slow down, you know. And I was trying to find every detail I possibly could, and there was nothing. I mean, the only thing I could see was the eyes, colorful suit, and the big orange nose and orange red hair, the wig, and the white gloves and the black shoe boots that she had on.
The clown turned and looked back at the scene for just a moment, then got back into the LeBaron and began to drive away. Joe didn't hesitate.
It was weird how good I reacted instead of freezing, because a lot of people do in those times. I just went right into reaction mode and got the phone and, you know, just got the keys of the car and started chasing. You know, it was chaos.
Joe jumped into a brand new red Pontiac Firebird that Michael had bought for Marlene out of the blue just months earlier.
She didn't even want it. She said, in my car, I don't want to get paint and stuff in it, you know, from the duplexes. And, oh, here, pushing it on her. So I was, you know, that another weird thing, you know, because she wasn't materialistic at all.
So Joe mostly drove the Firebird. That morning, he used it to chase his mom's killer. For 10 miles, he raced behind the LeBaron.
I got all the way to Southern Boulevard. I saw nothing, you know, and I was running red lights and everything. I mean, I put my own life in jeopardy. It was just, I was going to ram right into the car. I mean, this is what I was thinking in the process.
But Joe lost sight of the car and the clown got away. He drove back to his house, unsure of his mom's condition.
There was detectives in, ambulance there. They had her, I guess, stable. Which I felt good about that until I got to the hospital. And then it was like, whoa, reality set in. I'm never going to see her again, you know. The biggest thing was my grandmother had to tell him to turn the machine off because there was nothing there, you know. Nothing. I stayed there the whole day, that, you know, days just sitting there holding her hand, and I felt nothing, you know. So talking to her, you know, telling her, don't leave, you know.
Marlene died 2 days after the shooting, on Memorial Day, 1990. Marlene's murder was brazen and terrifying, but the investigation was also uncovering encouraging leads. And with two very obvious motives, money and love, it was clear Sheila and Michael were under scrutiny. Every day, the news headlines were revealing more. Employees of a costume shop told police that a customer who resembled Sheila had bought a clown suit and makeup days before the murder. Clerks at a Publix grocery store said Sheila resembled a customer who had bought a Memorial Day bouquet of flowers and two foil balloons hours before the clown aimed its pistol at Marlene. An abandoned white Chrysler LeBaron with ties to Michael's car lot was found in a grocery store parking lot days after Marlene's death, and not far from the Warrens' home. Orange, wig-like fibers were found in the back seat. But that's where the clown's trail ended. The obvious motives and bits of circumstantial evidence were far from solid proof of the killer's identity. The case withered over the weeks and months, and then went completely cold for 27 years. Joe told us that in the months that followed his mother's murder, his life was upside down. He had his suspicions about Michael and Sheila, but said he was adrift and alone, and easily manipulated by Michael, who was focused on money, insurance payouts, and his relationship with Sheila, and also with protecting himself.
I was very confused and you know, vulnerable state, and of course he's there to take advantage of it, you know, control it, so to speak. I remember I had to go down and talk to detectives, and I didn't have a lawyer, and his lawyer was right there. I was shutting down. I was being manipulated, and, you know, this car thing, and, you know, he was saying, this is what year, and it was a big deal, and I just finally told him, no, it was this, and I had to shut him down. He was trying to manipulate even that. At the end of the day, the duplexes, he took all the money out of them. They ended up putting a $450-some-thousand lien against them. You know, it goes on and on and on. Things were promised, like the insurance policy, you're supposed to get half for, you know, it's going to be hard and to carry on with your life, and never saw a dime. You know, I mean, like I said, I feel like I was a commodity to him, you know, and it shows by the actions.
While media coverage of the murder continued to focus the public's attention on Michael and Sheila, Michael was trying hard to deflect the suspicions. Around the one-year anniversary of the murder, Michael went on the defensive in a very public way. He agreed to go on a popular radio program on WJNO, and he brought Joe along to defend him.
You're listening to Mike Miller on WJNO.
We're talking about the death of Marlene Warren a year ago on May 26th of 1990. Somebody shot her wearing a clown outfit and left the home. Michael Warren with us, so too is his stepson, Marlene's son, Joe Ahrens, and John Wilbur, Mr. Warren's attorney in studio.
Michael was there to deny his involvement and to criticize investigators for targeting him, despite having no material proof.
And here we are now, a year and a week after that, and no one yet has been charged. But anybody who has followed this case knows that there are suspects involved in this case. One theory is that it was a woman in the clown outfit. And some have felt that that woman may have been a woman named Sheila Keene. Sheila Keene has been alleged to be a lover of Marlene Warren's husband, Michael. And because of that, the investigators of this case had made no secret whatsoever in, if not formal allegations, certainly insinuations that Michael Warren was involved in the murder of his wife. I'm sure many people in the audience are wondering at this point why
at this point in time, you've decided you want to sit down and be interviewed and talk about this case. What made you decide to accept our invitation?
Well, I believe that if the Sheriff's Department can make accusations and comments without any proof or anything to back it up and bring me to trial by the media, I feel like I should say something that at least fight back, because I feel like I've been whipped and beat against without any reason or proof of any type.
Mr. Warren, do you know anything about the shooting of your wife?
I do not know any more than the fact that my son has told me at the time that he was at the house.
Do you suspect anyone in particular as being the person dressed in the clown that day who came to the house and killed your wife?
No, I really don't. It's been a tragic thing, and it's been like living in hell for the last year that it's happened.
Joe sat next to Michael and Michael's lawyer, John Wilbur, for the entire live broadcast. He was asked about the day of the murder, then about the scrutiny on Michael by investigators and the media.
Did they question you, Joe, a lot about your stepfather regarding this?
Yes, they did.
What did they want to know?
What he was into, and basically what he does for a living and whatnot. And they told me they were investigating him a while back, and they never could prove anything against him, and they switched everything all around.
Did they ever ask you specifically whether or not you thought your stepfather might have been behind this?
Yes, they at first they were trying to blame who or anybody, I guess.
Well, they were fishing, obviously, for a suspect.
Right.
No question about that. But were you surprised when the line of questioning led you to believe that they were suspicious of your stepfather?
Right at first, what happened was, I didn't really trust him at first because of...
You didn't trust your stepfather?
Right, because of what happened. But now I trust him to the full extent.
Okay, what changed your mind? I mean, it would be very normal, and I'm sure, Mr. Warren, you would have to agree with this, that, I mean, you're the new father in the home. There's always, particularly when you're talking about grown-up kids, there's always some friction, tension sometimes over this. What first led you, Joe, to think that maybe your stepfather was behind this, and then what happened that changed your mind?
Well, my curiosity got to me, and I went to John Wilbur's office, and he went over it with me, kind of made me feel a little better about the situation. And he told me that they went to the best place they could go in Miami for a
polygraph
test, right?
Yep.
And that took a lot of pressure off.
The polygraph test.
Right. So what they're putting in the papers is really screwed up my mind a lot, because they're basically pointing towards him every time you read the paper.
Joe didn't have much more to say. He told listeners he didn't believe Michael and Sheila were having an affair, and that he couldn't imagine either of them being involved in the murder. But Michael and his lawyer had plenty more to say. Over 90 minutes that included taking phone calls from listeners. Today, Joe says his words were being influenced by Michael and his lawyer. In fact, he said, he didn't even know he was being taken for a radio interview that day.
He said, come on, let's go eat breakfast. And that was it. We were a block away and said, oh, I got to make a quick stop. He was this way, very manipulating, very controlling, very narcissistic. When somebody is manipulated, you do whatever they tell you to do.
Joe remained in South Florida for a time, then moved around to Las Vegas, then Iowa. His grief and anger led him to substance abuse.
We grow, mature, and we get connected, or we don't. I was not connected for 30 years. I was once when I was younger. And it affected my life traumatically, in every way. Emotional, physically, it was a living hell. He threw me on the side of the road like a bag of trash, man. I had to go through abandonment issues and all kinds of stuff. You don't even, just to get where I'm at, to be able to stand here and talk to you about it.
As Joe Ahrens worked to put his life back together, over the years, the investigation chilled, and the glare of the news media faded from the case. Until September 26, 2017, when stunning news came that thrust the case of the killer clown back into the spotlight. Sheila Keen had been arrested in Virginia and charged with the murder of Marlene Warren. And there was another bombshell. Sheila was now Sheila Keen Warren. She and Michael had married 15 years earlier and were living secretly in the Blue Ridge Mountains of Tennessee, where Sheila's friends and neighbors knew her as Debbie. It was an astonishing turn in the case. Finally, investigators said during the announcement, they had real physical evidence, including DNA test results that definitively pointed to Sheila. And, combined with witness testimony from the employees who sold the clown costume, the flowers, and the balloons, the case was strong enough to seek the death penalty.
If you're like me and refuse to let go of your skinny jeans, you're a millennial. And if you're a millennial, it's time to add Clarins Multi-Active Cream to your daily routine. Rooted in nature and innovated with science, Clarins has a long legacy of creating industry-first, plant-forward products. Using a skin charger complex made of 2% niacinamide and sea holly bioextract, Clarins Multi-Active Cream has been clinically proven to target the first visible signs of aging by smoothing lines and wrinkles, refining pores, evening tone and texture, and strengthening the skin's moisture barrier. While Multi-Active Cream can't bring back the golden age of boy bands, it can de-stress your skin. Clarins Multi-Active Cream is available online now. Go to clarins.com/truecrime and get Multi-Active Day and Night Cream for 10% off, a free welcome gift, plus free shipping on your first order. That's clarins.com/truecrime with promo code TRUECRIME. clarins.com/truecrime with promo code TRUECRIME.
Across South Florida, there was a sense that finally, the accused killer clown who shot and killed Marlene Warren would be brought to justice. The news media was covering every angle. What were Michael and Sheila doing up in Tennessee and Virginia? Who knew about their secret life? Why did it take so long to bring in a person who was a prime suspect almost 3 decades earlier? What is the new evidence against Sheila? And would it be enough to convince a jury that she's the killer clown? Then, just 2 months after her arrest, Sheila was in court for one of the most routine procedures in a case like this. Nearly every murder defendant does it. Sheila waived her right to a speedy trial. And from that moment on, the only juror that mattered in this murder case was time. And Sheila's lawyers were going to have plenty of it. Over the 5 years since Sheila Keen Warren's arrest, the murder case slogged its way through the court system. Each time a date for the trial start approached, it was delayed. It happened an astonishing 7 times. In 2020, it was the COVID pandemic that pushed off her trial yet again. At the time, Sheila stewed about the delays in letters she wrote to family and friends, including Michael Warren, from her jail cell in Belgrade, Florida. In one letter to a friend named Susan Hughes in Abingdon, Virginia, Sheila wrote, "It's so unfair to me having to wait this long. Going on 33 months now. It feels like 33 years to me." And there were still more delays to come. In mid-2022, Sheila's lawyers argued to the judge that the case still wasn't ready for trial. In the motion, they wrote that the age of the murder investigation, the delays since Sheila's arrest, and the pandemic created, quote, unforeseeable and unimaginable obstacles to Sheila's defense. It was the first real indication that there were serious cracks forming in the case against Sheila. Some key witnesses couldn't be found. They moved out of the state, and one even left the country. Others had stopped cooperating. Some had developed debilitating illnesses. And some witnesses had died. Still, the case marched on, and by early 2023, the latest trial date was approaching. This time, by all appearances, jury selection was about to begin. Palm Beach County State Attorney Dave Ehrenberg said the circumstantial evidence against Sheila was damning.
First off, you had a really strong and easily understood motive. You had a motive that any juror can understand. I mean, who else would go to an isolated part of the county? Wellington was pretty remote at that point in 1990. And murder a woman who had no known enemies without taking anything of value from the home, unless it was a crime of passion, the mistress. It's pretty obvious to when I explain this matter to people, it's the first place they go. It would be the mistress. It would be a cheating spouse, a mistress or a cheating spouse, you know. And then on top of that, you had a witness who was still alive from the costume store who recognized the defendant as the one who purchased the clown costume. You also had a witness at the Publix who said that the individual who purchased the flowers had a resemblance to the defendant. Now, it was not a perfect identification on that one, but there was a resemblance. And the fact is that the mistress ended up marrying Michael Warren just a few years later.
Then there was the actual evidence. A long brown hair had been found in the back of the Chrysler LeBaron that police said the clown used to escape. Sheila had long brown hair. Although DNA testing wasn't available in 1990, samples were tested years later, and prosecutors said the hair came from Sheila. Curly orange fibers were also found in the car, as well as tangled on the ribbons that were attached to the balloons delivered by the clown. The actual wig it wore that day had never been found, but prosecutors said the fibers were from the exact type of clown wig sold by the costume shop employees who identified Sheila. It was the state's most important physical evidence. But it's also the type of evidence that requires a high burden of proof in court. And Sheila's lawyers launched a damaging assault on the evidence that the judge hadn't yet ruled on just 3 weeks before the trial date. Her lead attorney, Greg Rosenfeld, said there were serious questions about the wig fibers that prosecutors said were found on the balloons left behind by the clown. A crime scene investigator had examined them on the day of the murder.
You know, this is a state's witness. When he collected the evidence, he, you know, examined the balloons, the balloon ribbons for trace evidence. He was tasked with looking for, evidence relating to a clown. And, you know, having processed the balloon and the balloon ribbons, he did not see a 6 to 8 inch wig-like fiber. He definitively stated in his deposition it wasn't there. The next day, the evidence went to a latent examiner.
Rosenfeld said that the following day, the evidence was examined again by another CSI investigator.
And, you know, he too processed the balloon, the ribbons. He took them out of the bag. He looked at them for, he visually inspected them for trace evidence, did a number of tests on the balloons and ribbons. And again, did not see a 6 to 8 inch wig-like fiber. And for, you know, the next 23, 24 years, you know, this, you know, balloon, these ribbons, you know, were handled by at least 14 different people and nobody saw this wig-like fiber.
But in 2014, an investigator re-examined the balloon ribbons and this time reported the now infamous curly orange wig fiber. Rosenfeld said the delayed discovery was baffling and could have led a jury to doubt its veracity. And he said the state's DNA evidence was at least as faulty.
But there were, you know, roughly 8 hairs that the FBI tested. And, you know, most of those hairs were, you know, not a match to Sheila Keem Warren's. That just goes to the number of people who were in the car. But speaking to the 2 hairs that are relevant in this case, one of them, the hair root, had male and female DNA. And the major contributor, and by major contributor, I mean the major source of the DNA, most of the DNA on this hair, 80% was male DNA. 20% was female DNA, and that was Sheila's DNA. Now, the DNA report from the FBI indicated that there was male and female DNA, but, you know, it's kind of bizarre. It didn't indicate, this was in the raw data, it didn't indicate that the male was the major contributor, you know, which means that hair sample belonged to a man, and it was contaminated with Sheila's DNA. So, you know, there goes, you know, one of their two hair samples. The second one, 4% of U.S. Caucasians have the same DNA. So that 1 in 25 people, that hair could have belonged to 1 in 25 U.S. Caucasians. And, you know, that's the state's, you know, groundbreaking DNA evidence. And it's so weak and it's so troubling that they couldn't even exclude Marlene Warren from the source of that second hair. And, you know, we now know that the DNA evidence shows absolutely nothing. You know, at most, it shows that at some point she could have been in that car. And that's evidence they already had back in 1990 when, you know, witnesses testified that everybody from Bargain Motors, you know, had been in that car at some point. That is probably not only one of the most problematic, you know, parts of the state's case, but, you know, just in terms of, you know, I'm just going to use the word, you know, a negligent investigation. So, you know, those were the state's two pieces of evidence that, you know, led to them, you know, arresting and, you know, as far as we're concerned, you know, wrongfully prosecuting Sheila Kean Warren.
State Attorney Arenberg was developing serious concerns about the holes being punched in his key evidence by Sheila's lawyers.
Yeah, you know, fibers were an important piece of evidence, the fibers that were found in the defendant's car and home, and a crucial link in the chain of custody of those fibers was the lead crime scene investigator who passed away of COVID. Also, the lead detective who could have assisted with the chain of custody became very ill and unable to testify. The judge was about to rule on the DNA, and the DNA wasn't nuclear DNA, the kind that jurors are used to today. This was something wasn't as strong, and that was in grave jeopardy of being suppressed because of a break in the chain of custody. So you had the fibers that we couldn't introduce, then you had the DNA that looked like that was going to be suppressed. And then you had other witnesses. Multiple other witnesses have died in the past 33 years.
Prosecutors faced a difficult decision. If a jury decides that Sheila is not guilty of being Marlene's killer, she would walk free.
You know, we still had a good faith basis to move ahead with the case, but the last thing we wanted was for a murder to be acquitted at trial because the clock worked against us. You know, you had a circumstantial case that I think would have had better success at the time it occurred back in 1990 than in the CSI era of today, where jurors expect to see DNA evidence or video evidence or other types of direct evidence tying the suspect to the crime. Here, we were undermined by the by the 33 years between the crime and the trial made it extra difficult for prosecutors. And every day that passed, memories faded, and it came to the point where we knew we had a good faith basis to proceed to trial, but we also knew that there was a growing chance that we would not be able to meet our high burden of proof.
In late April 2023, Joe Ahrens got the call from the state attorney. Joe was in Las Vegas for a funeral. His grandmother, Marlene's mother Shirley Twing, died weeks before the trial after waiting decades to see justice served to her daughter's killer. The prosecutor told him it was time to cut a deal with Sheila.
I'll tell you, he gave me a call and it came out of a surprise. I was in Vegas and my grandmother just died. And I had to deal with this as well. And I was like, whoa. So he wanted something at before the end of the day. And I told him, I'll work on it. It took about 3 days. I had to talk to my lawyer. I had to go through all the details, all in the details. We've got the detective that can't stand trial because of dementia. We've got witnesses that can't find. I mean, what would you do? She would walk. If she would have went to trial, she probably would have walked. I mean, I wasn't going to take that chance, give it to her.
And that's what they did, with Joe's permission. On Tuesday, April 25th, 32 years and 11 months after Marlene Warren's murder, Sheila Keen Warren told a judge that she was the person who dressed up as a clown and fired the fatal bullet. Sheila pleaded guilty to second-degree murder and was sentenced to 12 years in prison. It's a sentence that struck many as lenient.
If she were found guilty of the original charge, first-degree murder, say in a perfect world, she was found guilty of first-degree murder, she was not going to serve more than 25 years, because even if she got a life sentence, back then there was parole after 25 years, and she would have certainly received parole. So that was the upside. The upside was 25 years. And that's if you got a first-degree murder conviction. If she received a, if she got a conviction of second-degree murder, which is what she pled to, the sentencing guidelines at the time were between 12 and 17 years. So that's one reason why we accepted the 12 years, was because it's within the sentencing guidelines for second-degree murder.
Sheila's lead attorney said the decision to plead guilty was difficult for her as well.
It's a game of, Russian roulette, at that point. Unfortunately, we're in a system, with mandatory minimum sentences, where... people don't want to roll the dice, and, it's understandable. When you're told you can get out, if you plea, you'll be home in, what she knew to be 16 to 18 months. Or you can go to trial and, God forbid the jury gets it wrong, mandatory 25 years to life. The smart move and, the move most people would make would be to take that guarantee. And everybody says, well, why would you plead to something, something you didn't do? But, until you find yourself in this situation and you really have to, contemplate the two alternatives, it's a no-brainer. And that's the reality of our system. So just because somebody pleads guilty, it's not them confessing to the to a crime. It's them making a decision as to what's in their best interest.
Ehrenberg takes issue with that statement. Pleading guilty required Sheila to admit to the court that she pulled the trigger that day.
Well, she is a murderer. She murdered Marlene Warren. There's no dispute. She admitted it under oath in court. And, what her lawyer says outside of court does not negate what she admitted to the court when she was under oath. Like, it's imperfect. I wanted Sheila King Warren to serve the rest of her days in a prison cell. I thought that would have been, to me, that would have been true justice. But we also, you know, we don't live in the world of the ideal. We live in reality. And the reality of a 33-year-old cold case means there has to be some give and take when your evidence starts to falter.
With credit for the 5 years she'd already spent in jail, Sheila could walk free within the next 2 years.
Sheila's doing great. You know, she's, you know, relieved this is over. You know, she knows she didn't commit this crime. Her family knows, you know, she didn't commit this crime. Her friends, you know, they all know why she made this decision. They all know that, you know, in the end, it was the right move, you know, the safe bet, the guarantee. And, you know, she's looking forward to, you know, to going home in 16 months and, you know, getting on, you know, just moving on with her life.
And in the end, we got the best outcome we could achieve. It's far from perfect, but it does restore a measure of justice to Joseph and to the memory of his beloved mother.
For Joe Ahrens, the end of the case comes with deeply conflicted feelings over the decision he had to make.
You know, it's unsettling, but you have to settle with it because it is what it is. And if you don't, it's only going to eat you up, no one else. That's the reality of it. I once had to live through him and then remember my mother, and I totally changed, just the opposite. And I am so blessed for it. Through all this, you know, I do believe everything happens for a reason. Action, reaction.
Joe spoke about wanting to use his trauma and the peace he's found to try to help other people. It's something he learned from his mom.
Well, she was an angel. She was a beautiful soul. She would help anybody. You know, she was just a great person all the way around.
And although the criminal case against Sheila is over, Joe said he's considering options for filing a civil case over the murder of his mom and the decades of trauma he endured. And he remains steadfastly convinced that Sheila Keen Warren is a killer.
Today, there's no doubt that that woman was in that clown outfit. I'll tell you that. There's no doubt in my mind.
Thank you for listening to this special episode of Felonious Florida, The Killer Clown of Wellington. If you're a fan of this podcast, please rate us on Apple Podcasts and tell your friends about the show. And be sure to follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. You can also reach us by emailing feedback@feloniousflorida.com. You can listen to more episodes online at feloniousflorida.com or on the Wondery Plus and Apple Podcasts apps, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Felonious Florida is produced by the South Florida Sun Sentinel in association with Wondery. Angie DeMichael has been our reporter for this episode, with additional reporting from Rafael Olmeda. Audio from WJNO Radio comes from Court Records. Sound design and production by Sean Pitts. Website design by Carbell Multimedia. And I'm the host and producer of Felonious Florida, David Schutz. Felonious Florida was created by Lisa Arthur and Juan Ortega. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Felonious Florida ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
I understand that anybody who's paid attention to the media would have to come to the conclusion that I killed my wife.
Hi, my name is Zach Stewart-Pontier. I'm one of the filmmakers behind The Jinx, and I'm excited to bring you the official Jinx podcast. We'll be revisiting all 6 episodes of Part 1 and watching along with Part 2 as it airs on Max, starting April 21st.
Bye-bye.
The official Jinx podcast. Listen on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.